Realize how obvious you are. Frank grinned, not the least bit shamefaced. You can't blame a guy for trying.
Seriously, you should come. The floaters don't start till Monday morning, so it'll basically be just me and Sam having a chat about what we've got. Aren't you curious?
Of course I was. All Frank's info hadn't told me the one thing I wanted to know. What this girl had been like. I leaned my head back on the futon and lit another smoke.
Do you seriously think we could pull this off?
I asked.
Frank considered this. He poured himself another glass of wine and waved the bottle at me. I shook my head. Under normal circumstances, he said at last, settling back into the sofa. I'd say probably not. But these aren't normal circumstances, and we've got a couple of things in our favor besides the obvious. For one thing, to all intents and purposes, this girl only existed for 3 years. It's not like you'd have to deal with a lifetime's worth of history here. You don't have to get by parents or siblings. You're not going to run into some childhood friend. Nobody's going to ask if you remember your first school dance. For another thing, during those 3 years, her life seems to have been pretty tightly circumscribed. She ran with one small crowd, studied in one small department, held down one job. You don't need to get the hang of wide circles of family and friends and colleagues. She was doing a PhD in English literature, I pointed out. I know zip about English literature, Frank. I got an A in my Leaving Cert, but that's it. I don't speak the jargon. Frank shrugged. Neither did Lexi, as far as we know, and she managed to pull it off. If she can do it, so can you. Again, we're in luck there. She could have been doing pharmacy or engineering. And if you get sweet fuck all done on her thesis, well, hey, what do they expect? Ironically enough, that stab wound's going to come in useful. We can give you post-traumatic stress, amnesia, whatever we fancy. Any boyfriend? There is a limit to what I'm prepared to do for the job. Nope. So your virtue is safe. And the other thing working for us, you know those photos? Our girl had a video phone, and it looks like the five of them used it as the group camcorder. The image quality's not brilliant, but she had a whacking great memory card and it's packed with clips. Her and her mates on nights out, on picnics, moving into their new gaff, doing it up, everything. So you've got a ready-made guide to her voice, her body language, mannerisms, the tone of the relationships, everything a girl could ask for. And you're good, Cassie. You're a damn fine undercover. Put it all together, and I'd say we're in with a pretty good chance of pulling this off. He tipped up the glass to get the last drops and reached for his jacket. Been fun catching up, babe. You have my mobile number. Let me know what you decide about tomorrow night. And he let himself out. It was only as the door shut behind him that I realized what I had slipped into asking. What about college? Any boyfriend? As if I were checking the plan for holes. As if I were thinking about doing it. Frank's always had a knack for knowing exactly when to leave it. After he'd gone, I sat on the windowsill for a long time, staring out over the rooftops without seeing them. It was only when I got up for another glass of wine that I realized he had left something on my coffee table. It was a photo of Lexi and her mates in front of Whitethorn House. I stood there, with the wine bottle in one hand and my glass in the other, and thought about turning it face down and leaving it there till Frank gave up and came back for it. Thought, for a minute, about sticking it in an ashtray and burning it. Then I picked it up and brought it back to the windowsill with me. She could have been any age. She'd been passing for 26, but I would have believed 19 or 30. There wasn't a mark on her face, not a line or a scar or a chickenpox blemish. Whatever life had thrown at her before Lexi Madison fell into her lap, it had rolled over her and burned off like mist, left her untouched and pristine, sealed without a crack. I looked older than her. Operation Vestal gave me my first lines around my eyes, and shadows that didn't go away with a good night's sleep. I could practically hear Frank.
You lost a shitload of blood and you've been in a coma for days. The eye bags are perfect. Don't go using night cream.
At her shoulders, the housemates watched me, poised and smiling, long dark coats billowing and Rafe's scarf a flash of crimson. The angle of the shot was a little off kilter. They had propped the camera on something, used a timer. There was no photographer on the other side telling them to say cheese. Those smiles were private things, just for one another, for their someday selves looking back, for me. And behind them, almost filling the shot, Whitethorn House. It was a simple house, a wide grey Georgian, three stories, with the sash windows getting smaller as they went up, to give the illusion of even more height. The door was deep blue, paint peeling away in big patches. A flight of stone steps led up to it on either side. Three neat rows of chimney pots, thick drifts of ivy sweeping up the walls almost to the roof. The door had fluted columns and a peacock's tail fanlight. But apart from that, there was no decoration. Just the house. This country's passion for property is built into the blood. A current as huge and primal as desire. Centuries of being turned out on the roadside at a landlord's whim. Helpless. Teach your bones that everything in life hangs on owning your home. This is why house prices are what they are. Property developers know they can charge $500,000 for a one-bedroom dive. If they band together and make sure there's no other choice, the Irish will sell a kidney, work 100-hour weeks and pay it. Somehow, maybe it's the French blood. That gene missed me. The thought of a mortgage round my neck makes me edgy. I like the fact that my flat is rented. 4 weeks' notice and a couple of bin liners and I could be gone any time I choose. If I had ever wanted a house, though, it would have been a lot like this one. This had nothing in common with the characterless pseudo-houses all my friends were buying. Shrunken, middle-of-nowhere shoeboxes that come with great spurts of sticky euphemisms. Architect-designed bijou residence in brand-new luxury community. And sell for 20 times your income and are built to last just till the developer can get them off his hands. This was the real thing. One serious do-not-fuck-with-me house with the strength and pride and grace to outlast everyone who saw it. Tiny swirling flecks of snow blurred the ivy and hung in the dark windows. And the silence of it was so huge that I felt like I could put my hand straight through the glossy surface of the photo and down into its cool depths. I could find out who this girl was and what had happened to her without ever going in there. Sam would tell me when they got an ID or a suspect. Probably he would even let me watch the interrogation. But right at the bottom of me, I knew that was all he would ever get. Her name and her killer. And I would be left to wonder about everything else for the rest of my life. That house shimmered in my mind like some fairy fort that appeared for one day in a lifetime, tantalizing and charged, with those four cool figures for guardians and inside secrets too hazy to be named. My face was the one pass that would unbar the door. Whitethorn House was ready and waiting to whisk itself away to nothing the instant I said no. I realized the photo was about 3 inches from my nose. I had been sitting there long enough that it was getting dark, the owls doing their warm-up exercises above the ceiling. I finished off the wine and watched the sea turn thunder-colored. The blink of the lighthouse far off on the horizon. When I figured I was drunk enough not to care if he gloated, I texted Frank. What time is that meeting? My phone beeped about 10 seconds later. 7 sharp. See you there. He had had his mobile ready to hand, waiting for me to say yes. That evening, Sam and I had our first fight. This was probably overdue, given that we'd been going out for 3 months without even a mild disagreement. But the timing sucked all round. Sam and I got together a few months after I left murder. I'm not sure exactly how that happened. I don't remember a whole lot about that period. I appear to have bought a couple of truly depressing sweaters, the kind you only wear when all you really want is to curl up under the bed for several years, which occasionally made me wonder about the wisdom of any relationship I had acquired around the same time. Sam and I had got close on Operation Vestal, stayed that way after the walls came tumbling down. The nightmare cases do that to you, that or the opposite. And long before the case ended, I had decided he was pure gold. But a relationship with anyone was the last thing I had in mind. He got to my place around 9.
"Hi, you,"
he said, giving me a kiss and a full-on hug. His cheek was cold from the wind outside.
"Something smells good."
The flat smelled of tomatoes and garlic and herbs. I had a complicated sauce simmering and water boiling and a huge packet of ravioli at the ready. Going by the same principle women have followed since the dawn of time, if you have something to tell him that he doesn't want to hear, make sure there is food. "I'm being domesticated," I told him. "I cleaned and everything. Hi, honey. How's your day?"
"Ah, sure,"
Sam said vaguely.
"We'll get there in the end."
As he pulled off his coat, his eyes went to the coffee table. Wine bottles, corks, glasses.
"Have you been seeing fancy men behind my back?"
"Frank," I said. "Not very fancy." The laughter went out of Sam's face.
"Oh,"
he said. "What did he want?" I had been hoping to save this for after dinner. For a detective, my crime scene cleanup skills suck.
"He wanted me to come to your case meeting tomorrow night," I said, as casually as I could, heading over to the kitchenette to check the garlic bread.
"He went at it sideways, but that's what he was after." Slowly Sam folded his coat, draped it over the back of the sofa.
"What did you say?"
"I thought about it a lot," I said. "I want to go."
"He had no right," Sam said quietly.
A red flush was starting high on his cheekbones.
"Coming here behind my back, putting pressure on you when I wasn't there to..."
"I would have decided exactly the same way if you'd been standing right here," I said. "I'm a big girl, Sam. I don't need protecting."
"I don't like that fella," Sam said sharply. "I don't like the way he thinks and I don't like the way he works."
I slammed the oven door.
"He's trying to solve this case. Maybe you don't agree with the way he's doing it."
Sam shoved hair out of his eyes hard with his forearm.
"No," he said. "No, he's not. It's not about solving the case. That fella Mackie, this case has bugger all to do with him. No more than any other murder I've worked. And I didn't see him showing up on those ones pulling strings right and left to get in the action. He's here for the crack, so he is. He thinks it'll be a great laugh, throwing you into the middle of a bunch of murder suspects, just because he can, and then waiting to see what happens. The man's bloody mad!"
I pulled plates out of the cupboard.
"So what if he is? All I'm doing is going to a meeting. What's the huge big deal?" "That mentler's using you is the big deal. You've not been yourself since that business last year."
The words sent something straight through me. A swift, vicious jolt like the shock from an electric fence. I whipped round on him, forgetting all about dinner. All I wanted to do with the plates was throw them at Sam's head.
"Oh no, don't, Sam. Don't bring that into this." "It's already in it. Your man Mackie took one look at you and he knew something was up. Figured he'd have no problem pushing you into going along with his mad idea."
The possessiveness of him, standing in the middle of my floor with his feet planted and his fists jammed furiously in his pockets. "My case, my woman." I banged the plates down on the counter.
"I don't give a flying fuck what he figured. He's not pushing me into anything. This has nothing to do with what Frank wants. It's got nothing to do with Frank, full stop. Sure he tried to bulldoze me. I told him to fuck off." "You're doing exactly what he asks you to. How the hell is that telling him to fuck off?"
For a crazy second, I wondered if he could actually be jealous of Frank. And if he was, what the hell I was supposed to do about it. And if I don't go to the meeting, I'll be doing exactly what you ask me to. Would that mean I'm letting you push me around? I decided I wanted to go tomorrow. You think I'm not able to do that all by myself? Jesus Christ, Sam. Last year didn't lobotomize me. That's not what I said. I'm just saying you haven't been yourself since. This is myself, Sam. Take a good look. This is my fucking self. I did undercover years before Operation Vessel ever came along, so leave that out of it.
We stared at each other. After a moment, Sam said quietly,
Yeah, I suppose you did.
He dropped down on the sofa and ran his hands over his face. All of a sudden he looked wrecked, and the thought of what his day had been like sent a pang through me.
Sorry, he said, for bringing that up.
I'm not trying to get into an argument, I said. My knees were shaken, and I had no idea how we had ended up fighting about this when we were basically on the same side. Just leave it, okay? Please, Sam. I'm asking you.
Cassie, Sam said. His round, pleasant face had a look of anguish that didn't belong there.
I can't do this. What if... God! What if something happens to you? On my case that had nothing to do with you, because I couldn't bloody well get my man. I can't live with that. I can't.
He sounded breathless, winded. I didn't know whether to hold him tight or kick him.
What makes you think this has nothing to do with me? I demanded. This girl is my double, Sam. This girl was going around wearing my fucking face. How do you know your guy got the right one? Think about it. A post-grad who spends her time reading Charlotte Bloody Bronte, or a detective who's put dozens of people away. Who's more likely to have someone out to kill her?
There was a silence. Sam had worked in Operation Vestal too. Both of us knew at least one person who would happily have had me killed without a second thought, and who was well able to get the job done. I could feel my heart banging, hard and high under my ribs.
Sam said, Are you thinking?
Specific cases aren't the point, I said, too curtly. The point is, for all we know, I could be involved up to my tits already, and I don't want to be looking over my shoulder for the rest of my life. I can't live with that.
He flinched. It wouldn't be for the rest of your life, he said quietly. I hope I can promise you that much at least. I do plan to get this fella, you know.
I leaned back against the counter and took a breath. I know, Sam, I said. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it that way.
If God forbid he was after you, then all the more reason to stay out of the way and let me find him.
The cheerful cooking smell had grown an acrid, dangerous edge. Something was starting to burn. I switched off the cooker, shoved the pans to the back. Neither of us was going to feel like eating for a while. And sat down cross-legged on the sofa, facing Sam.
You're treating me like your girlfriend, Sam, I said. I'm not your girlfriend. Not when it comes to this kind of thing. I'm just another detective.
He gave me a sad, sideways little smile.
Could you not be both?
I hope so, I said.
I wished I hadn't finished the wine. This man needed a drink.
I really do, but not like this.
After a while, Sam let out a long breath, let his head fall back against the sofa.
So you want to do it, he said. Mackie's plan?
No, I said. I just want to know about this girl. That's why I said I'd go to the meeting. It's got nothing to do with Frank and his wacko idea. I just want to hear about her.
Why?
Sam demanded, He sat up and caught both my hands, making me look at him. There was a ragged edge to his voice, something frustrated and almost pleading.
What's she got to do with you? She's no relation to you, no friend of yours, nothing. She's happenstance is all. Cassie. Some girl who was looking for a new life and ran into the perfect chance.
I know, I said. I know, Sam. She doesn't even sound like a particularly nice person. If we'd met, I probably wouldn't have liked her. That's the whole point. I don't want her in my head. I don't want to be wondering about her. I'm hoping that if I find out enough about her, I can drop the whole thing and forget she ever existed.
I've a double, Sam said. He lives in Wexford. He's an engineer, and that's all I know about the man. About once a year, someone comes up to me and tells me I'm the spit of him. Half the time, they actually call me Brendan. We have a laugh about it. Sometimes they take a photo of me on their phones to show him. And that's the end of that.
I shook my head. That's different.
How?
For one thing, he hasn't been murdered.
No harm to the man, Sam said. But I wouldn't give a damn if he were. Unless I caught the case, it'd be no problem of mine.
This girl's my problem, I said. Sam's hands were big and warm and solid around mine, and his hair was falling across his forehead like it always does when he's worried. It was a spring Saturday night. We should have been walking on some beach down the country, surrounded by dark and waves and curlews, or making something experimental for dinner and playing music too loud, or settled in a corner of one of those rare, out-of-the-way pubs where people still sing ballads when it gets past closing time. I wish she wasn't, but she is.
There's something here, Sam said, that I'm not getting.
He had let our hands drop onto my knees and was frowning down at them, running his thumb around one of my knuckles in a steady automatic rhythm.
All I'm seeing is a bog-standard murder case, with a coincidence that could happen to anyone. Sure, I got a shock when I saw her, but that's only because I thought it was you. Once that was sorted, I figured everything would go back to normal. But you and Mackie, you're both acting like this girl was something to you. Like it's personal. What am I missing?
In a way, I said. It is personal, yeah. For Frank, partly it's exactly what you said. He thinks it would all be a big, brilliant adventure. But it's more than that. Lexi Madison started out as his responsibility. She was his responsibility for 8 months while I was under. She's his responsibility now.
But this girl isn't Lexi Madison. She's an identity thief. I could go down to fraud in the morning and find you hundreds more just like her. There's no Lexi Madison. You and Mackie made her up.
His hands had tightened on mine. I know, I said. That's sort of the point. The corner of Sam's mouth twisted.
Like I said, the man's mad.
I didn't exactly disagree with him. I've always thought one of the reasons for Frank's legendary fearlessness is that, way deep down, he's never quite managed to connect with reality. To him, every operation is one of those war games the Pentagon plays, only even cooler, because the stakes are higher and the results are tangible and long-lasting. The fracture is small enough, and he's smart enough that it never shows in obvious ways. But while he's keeping every angle covered and every situation beautifully, icily under control, some part of him truly believes he's being played by Sean Connery. I spotted this because I recognize it. My own border fence between real and not real has never been all that great. My friend Emma, who likes things to add up neatly, claims that this is because my parents died when I was too young to take it in. They were there one day and gone the next, crashing through that fence so hard and fast they left it splintered for good. When I was Lexi Madison for 8 months, she turned into a real person to me, a sister I lost or left behind on the way, a shadow somewhere inside me, like the shadows of vanishing twins that show up on people's x-rays once in a blue moon. Even before she came back to find me, I knew I owed her something. for being the one who lived.
This was presumably not what Sam wanted to hear. He had enough on his plate without adding several new flavors of weird into the mix. Instead, it was the closest I could get. I tried to tell him about undercover. I told him how your senses are never quite the same again, how colors turn fierce enough to brand you, and the air tastes bright and jagged as that clear liqueur filled with tiny flakes of gold, how the way you walk changes, your balance turns fine and taut as a surfer's, when you spend every second on the shifting edge of a fast, risky wave. I told him how afterwards I never shared a spliff with my mates or took E in a club again, because no high could ever compare. I told him how damn good at it I was. A natural. Better than I'll be at DV in a million years. When I finished, Sam was looking at me with a worried little furrow between his eyebrows.
"What are you saying?" he asked. "Are you saying you want to transfer back into undercover?"
He had taken his hands off mine. I looked at him, sitting across the sofa with his hair rocked up on one side, frowning at me. "No," I said. "That's not it." And watched his face clear in relief. "That's not it at all." This is the part I didn't tell Sam. Bad stuff happens to undercovers. A few of them get killed. Most lose friends, marriages, relationships. A couple turn feral, cross over to the other side so gradually that they never see it happening till it's too late, and end up with discreet, complicated early retirement plans. Some, and never the ones you think, lose their nerve. No warning. They just wake up one morning and all at once it hits them what they're doing, and they freeze like tightrope walkers who've looked down. This guy McCall, he had infiltrated an IRA splinter group and nobody thought he even knew what fear was. Till one evening, he phoned in from an alleyway outside a pub. He couldn't go back in there, he said, and he couldn't walk away because his legs wouldn't stop shaking. He was crying. "Come get me," he said. "I want to go home." When I met him, he was working in records. And some go the other way. The most lethal way of all. When the pressure gets to be too much, it's not their nerve that breaks, it's their fear. They lose the capacity to be afraid, even when they should be. These can't ever go home again. They're like those First World War airmen, the finest ones, shining in their recklessness and invincible, who got home and found that home had no place for what they were. Some people are undercovers all the way to the bone. The job has taken them whole. I was never afraid of getting killed, and I was never afraid of losing my nerve. My kind of courage holds up best under fire. It's different dangers, more refined and insidious ones that shake me. But the other things? I worried about those. Frank told me once, and I don't know whether he's right or not, and I didn't tell Sam this either, that all the best undercovers have a dark thread woven into them, somewhere. Chapter 3. So, on Sunday evening, Sam and I went to Dublin Castle for Frank's Council of War. Dublin Castle is where the murder squad works. I had cleared out my desk there on another long, cool evening in autumn, stacked my paperwork in neat piles and labelled each pile with a post-it, thrown away the cartoons stuck to my computer and the chewed pens and old Christmas cards and stale M&Ms in my desk drawers, turned off the light and closed the door behind me. Sam picked me up. He was very quiet. He had been up and out early that morning, so early that the flat was still dark when he leaned over to kiss me goodbye. I didn't ask him about the case. If he had found anything good,
Even the slimmest lead, he would have told me.
Don't let your man pressure you, he said in the car, into doing anything you don't want to.
Come on, I said. When have I ever let anyone pressure me into anything?
Sam adjusted his rear-view mirror carefully.
Yeah, he said. I know.
When he unlocked the door, the smell of the building came at me like a shout. An old, elusive smell, damp and smoke and lemon. Nothing like the antiseptic tang of DV in the new building up in Phoenix Park. I hate nostalgia. It's laziness with prettier accessories. But every step hit me straight in the gut with something. Me running down those stairs with a bunch of files in each hand, and an apple caught between my teeth. My partner and me high-fiving each other outside that door, after getting our first confession in that interview room. The two of us double-teaming the superintendent down that hallway, one in each ear, trying to hassle him into giving us more overtime. It seemed like the corridors had an Escher look, the walls all tilting in subtle seasick ways. But I couldn't focus my eyes enough to figure out exactly how.
How are you doing?
Sam asked quietly. Starving, I said. Whose idea was it to do this at dinner time? Sam smiled, relieved, and gave my hand a quick squeeze.
We don't have an incident room yet, he said, till we decide, well, how we're doing this, where we're working out of.
Then he opened the door of the murder squad room. Frank was straddling a backwards chair at the head of the room, in front of the big white board. And all his reassurances about a casual chat between him and me and Sam had been bollocks. Cooper, the state pathologist, and O'Kelly, the superintendent of the murder squad, were sitting at desks on opposite sides of the room with their arms folded, wearing identical, narky looks. This should have been funny. Cooper looks like a heron, and O'Kelly looks like a bulldog with a comb-over. But actually, it gave me a very bad feeling. Cooper and O'Kelly hate each other. Getting them in the same room for any length of time takes a lot of skilled persuasion and a couple of bottles of pretty serious wine. For some cryptic reason of his own, Frank had pulled out all the stops to get them both there. Sam shot me a wary, warning glance. He hadn't been expecting this either.
Maddox,
O'Kelly said, managing to make it sound injured. O'Kelly never had any use for me when I was on murder, but the second I applied for a transfer, I somehow morphed into the serpent's tooth protege who snubbed years of devoted mentoring and buggered off to DV.
How's life in the minor leagues?
All sunshine and flowers, sir, I said. When I'm tense, I get flippant. Evening, Dr. Cooper.
Always a pleasure, Detective Maddox, said Cooper.
He ignored Sam. Cooper hates Sam, too, and more or less everyone else. I'd stayed in his good books so far, but if he discovered I was going out with Sam, I would shoot down his Christmas card list at the speed of light.
At least in murder, O'Kelly said, giving my ripped jeans a fishy look.
For some reason, I hadn't been able to bring myself to wear my nice, new, appropriate image clothes, not for this.
Most of us can afford decent gear. How's Ryan getting on?
I wasn't sure whether the question was bitchy or not. Rob Ryan used to be my partner, back in murder. I hadn't seen him in a while. I hadn't seen O'Kelly either, or Cooper. Not since I'd transferred out. This was all happening too fast and out of control.
Sends love and kisses, I said. Can't say I didn't suspect,
O'Kelly said, and sniggered at Sam, who looked away. The squad room holds 20, but it was Sunday evening empty. Computers off, desks scattered with paperwork and fast food wrappers. The cleaners don't come in till Monday morning. In the back corner by the window, the desks, where Rob and I used to sit, were still at right angles, the way we liked them, so we could be shoulder to shoulder. Some other team, maybe the newbies brought in to replace us, had taken them over. Whoever was at my desk had a kid. silver-framed photo of a grinning little boy with his front teeth missing, and a pile of statement sheets, sun falling across them. It always used to get in my eyes, this time of day. I was having a hard time breathing. The air felt too thick, almost solid. One of the fluorescents was on the fritz, and it gave the room a shimmery epileptic look, something out of a fever dream. A couple of the big binders lined up on the filing cabinets still had my handwriting down the spines. Sam pulled up his chair to his desk and glanced at me with a faint furrow between his eyebrows. But he didn't say anything, and I was grateful for that. I concentrated on Frank's face. There were bags under his eyes, and he had cut himself shaving. But he looked wide awake, alert, and energized. He was looking forward to this. He caught me watching him.
Glad to be back.
Ecstatic, I said. I wondered, suddenly, if he had got me into this room deliberately, knowing it might throw me. I dropped my satchel on a desk. Costello's. I knew the handwriting on the paperwork. Leaned back against the wall and stuck my hands in my jacket pockets.
Companionable though this may be, Cooper said, edging a little farther from O'Kelly. I, for one, would be delighted to come to the point of this little gathering.
Fair enough, Frank said. The Madison case. Well, the Jane Doe alias Madison case. What's the official name?
Operation Murrer, Sam said.
Obviously the word about the victim's looks had spread as far as headquarters. Beautiful. I wondered whether it was too late to change my mind, go home and order pizza. Frank nodded.
Operation Murrer it is. It's been 3 days, and we've got no suspects, no leads, and no ID. As you all know, I think it might be time to try a different tack.
Hold your horses there, O'Kelly said. We'll get to your different tack in a moment. Don't you worry about that. But first, I've a question.
Off you go,
Frank said magnanimously, with an expansive gesture to match. O'Kelly gave him a dirty look. There was an awful lot of testosterone circulating in this room.
Unless I'm missing something, he said. This girl was murdered. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Mackie, but I'm not seeing any indication of domestic violence, and I'm not seeing anything that says she was undercover. Why did you people?
He jerked his chin at me and Frank.
Want in on this one to begin with?
I didn't, I told him.
I don't. The victim was using an identity I created for one of my officers, Frank said. And I take that pretty personally. So you're stuck with me. You may or may not be stuck with Detective Maddox. That's what we're here to find out.
I can tell you that right now, I said.
Humor me, Frank said. Don't tell me till I've finished. Once you've heard me out, you can tell me to fuck off all you like, and I won't say a word. Doesn't that sound like fun?
I gave up. This is another of Frank's skills, the ability to sound like he's making a vast concession, so that you come across as an unreasonable cow if you won't meet him halfway.
Sounds like a dream date, I said.
Fair enough,
Frank asked everyone.
At the end of this evening, you tell me to climb back in my box, and I'll never mention my little idea again. Just hear me out first. Is that okay with everyone?
O'Kelly grunted non-committally. Cooper gave a not-my-problem shrug. Sam, after a moment, nodded. I was getting that specific feeling of Frank-related impending doom.
And before we all get too carried away, Frank said, let's make sure the resemblance stands up to a closer look. If it doesn't, then there's no point fighting about it, is there?
Nobody answered. He swung himself off the chair, pulled a handful of photos out of his file, and started blue-tacking them to the whiteboard. The shot from the Trinity ID, blown up to 8x10. The dead girl's face in profile, eye closed and bruised-looking. A full-length shot of her on the autopsy table, still dressed, thank Jesus, with her fists clenched on top of that dark star of blood. a close-up of her hands, unfurled and stippled with brownish black, streaks of silver nail polish showing through the blood.
Cassie, could you do me a favor? Stand over here for a minute.
You fucker, I thought. I peeled myself off the wall, went to the whiteboard and stood against it like I was having a mugshot taken. I would have bet good money that Frank had already pulled my photo from records and compared it to these with a magnifying glass. He prefers to ask questions to which he already knows the answers.
We should really be using the actual body for this, Frank told us cheerfully, biting a piece of blue tack in half. But I figured that might be a little weird.
God forbid, said O'Kelly. I wanted Rob. Damn it. I had never let myself think that before. Not one time in all the months since we'd stopped talking. No matter how tired I got or how late at night it was. At first, I wanted to kick his ass so badly it was doing my head in. I was throwing things at my wall on a regular basis, so I stopped thinking about him altogether. But the squad room all around me, and the four of them peering intently as if I were some exotic forensic exhibit, and those photos so close to my cheek I could feel them. The acid trip feeling I'd had all week was swelling into a wild, dizzying wave, and I hurt somewhere under my breastbone. I would have sold a limb to have Rob there for just one instant, raising a sardonic eyebrow at me behind O'Kelly's back, pointing out blandly that the swap would never work because the dead girl had been pretty. For a vicious second, I could have sworn I smelled his aftershave.
Eyebrows, Frank said, tapping the ID shot.
I had to stop myself from jumping.
Eyebrows are good. Eyes are good. Lexi's fringe is shorter. You'll need a trim. Apart from that, the hair's good.
Ears.
Turn to the side for a second. Ears are good. Yours pierced?
3 times, I said.
She only had 2. Let's have a look.
Frank leaned in.
Shouldn't be a problem. I can't even see them unless I'm looking for them.
Nose is good. Mouth is good. Chin's good. Jawline's good.
Sam blinked, a rapid flick like a wince on every one.
Your cheekbones and clavicles appear to be more pronounced than the victim's, Cooper said, studying me with vaguely creepy professional interest. May I ask how much you weigh?
I never weigh myself.
100 and something. 16? 17?
You're a little thinner than she was, Frank said. No problem. A week or two of hospital food will do that. Her clothes are size 6. Jeans, waist 29 inches. Bra size, 34B. Shoe size 7. All of that sound like it'll fit?
Near enough, I said. I wondered how the fuck my life had ended up here. I thought about finding some magic button that would rewind me, at lightning speed, till I was lounging happily in the back corner, kicking Rob in the leg every time O'Kelly came out with a cliche, instead of standing here like a muppet, showing people my ears and trying to stop my voice shaking while we discussed whether I would fit into a dead girl's bra.
A brand new wardrobe, Frank told me, grinning. Who says this job doesn't have perks?
She could do with it, O'Kelly said bitchily.
Frank moved on to the full-length shot, drew a finger down it from shoulders to feet, glancing back and forth at me.
Build is all good, give or take the few pounds.
His finger on the photo made a long, dragon squeak. Sam shifted sharply in his chair.
Shoulder width looks good. Waist-to-hip ratio looks good. We can measure just to be sure, but the weight difference gives us a little leeway there. Leg length looks good.
He tapped the close-up.
These are important. People notice hands. Give us a look, Cassie.
I held out my hands like he was going to cuff me. I couldn't make myself look at the photo. I could barely breathe. This was one question to which Frank couldn't already know the answer. This could be it. The difference that would slice me away from this girl, sever the link with one hard final snap, and let me go home.
Those right there,
Frank said appreciatively, after a long look.
Maybe the loveliest hands I've ever seen.
Extraordinary, Cooper said with relish, leaning forwards to peer at me and a nonny girl over his glasses.
The odds must be one in millions.
Anyone seeing any discrepancies? Frank asked the room.
No one said anything. Sam's jaw was tight.
Gentlemen, Frank said with a flourish of his arm,
we have a match.
Which doesn't necessarily mean we need to do anything with it, said Sam.
O'Kelly was doing a sarcastic, slow clap.
Congratulations, Mackie. Makes a great party trick. Now that we all know what Maddox looks like, can we get back to the case?
And can I stop standing here? I asked. My legs were trembling like I'd been running, and I was furiously pissed off with everyone in sight, including myself.
Unless you need me for inspiration.
You can, of course, Frank said, finding a marker for the whiteboard.
So, here's what we've got. Alexandra Janet Madison, a.k.a. Lexi, registered as born in Dublin on the 1st of March 1979, and I should know, I registered her myself. In October 2000,
he started sketching a timeline, fast, straight strokes.
She entered UCD as a psychology postgrad. In May of 2001, she dropped out of college due to stress-related illness and went to her parents in Canada to recover. And that should have been the end of her. Hang on. You gave me a nervous breakdown, I demanded.
Your thesis was getting on top of you, Frank told me, grinning. It's a tough old world, academia. You couldn't take the heat, so you got out of the kitchen.
I had to get rid of you somehow.
I rearranged myself against my wall and made a face at him. He winked at me. He had played straight into this girl's hands, years before she ever came on the scene. Any slip she made when she ran into that old acquaintance and started trawling for info, any off-kilter pause, any reluctance to meet up again. Well, you know she did have that nervous breakdown.
In February 2002, though, Frank said, switching from blue marker to red, Alexandra Madison shows up again. She pulls her UCD records and uses them to wangle her way into Trinity to do a PhD in English. We don't have a clue who this girl actually is, what she was doing before then, or how she hit on the Lexi Madison ID. We ran her prints. She's not in the system.
You might want to widen the net, I said. There's a decent chance she's not Irish. Frank glanced at me sharply.
Why's that?
When Irish people want to hide, they don't hang around here. They go abroad.
If she was Irish, she'd have run into someone from her mammy's bingo club inside a week.
Not necessarily. She was living a pretty isolated life.
As well as that, I said, keeping my voice level. I take after the French side. Nobody thinks I'm Irish till I open my mouth. If I didn't get my looks here, odds are neither did she.
Great, O'Kelly said heavily. Undercover, DV, immigration, the Brits, Interpol, the FBI, anyone else who might want to join the party. The Irish Countrywoman's Association, the Vincent de Paul.
Any chance of getting an ID off her teeth? Sam asked. Or a country even. Can't you tell where dental work was done?
The young woman in question had excellent teeth, Cooper said. I am not, of course, a specialist in the field, but she had no fillings, crowns, extractions, or other readily identifiable work. Frank arched an inquiring eyebrow at me. I gave him my best puzzled look.
The two bottom front teeth overlap slightly, Cooper said, and one top molar is significantly misaligned, implying that she had no orthodontic work done as a child. I would hazard that the possibility of dental identification is practically non-existent.
Sam shook his head, frustrated, and went back to his notebook. Frank was still eyeballing me, and it was getting on my nerves. I shoved myself off the wall, opened my mouth wide at him and pointed at my teeth. Cooper and O'Kelly gave me identical horrified looks.
No, I don't have fillings, I told Frank. See? Not that it matters anyway.
Good girl, Frank said approvingly.
Keep flossing.
That's lovely, Maddox, O'Kelly said. Thanks for sharing. So, in autumn of 2002, Alexandra Madison goes into Trinity, and in April 2005 she turns up murdered outside Glenskeighy. Do we know what she was doing in between?
Sam stirred and looked up, put down his pen.
Her PhD, mostly, he said. Something to do with woman writers and pseudonyms. I didn't understand the whole of it. She was doing grand, her supervisor says. A bit behind schedule, but what she came up with was good. Up until September, she was living in a bedsit off the South Circular Road. She paid her way with student loans, grants, and by working in the English department and in caffeine in town. She had no known criminal activity, no debts except a loan for her college fees, no dodgy activity on her bank account, no addictions, no boyfriend or ex-boyfriend.
Cooper raised an eyebrow.
No enemies and no recent arguments.
So no motive, Frank said musingly to the whiteboard, and no suspects.
Her main associates, Sam said evenly, were a bunch of other postgrads. Daniel March, Abigail Stone, Justin Mannerin, and Raphael Highland.
Bloody silly name, said O'Kelly.
He a puff or a Brett?
Cooper closed his eyes briefly in distaste like a cat.
He's half English, Sam said.
O'Kelly gave a smug little grunt.
Daniel has two speeding tickets. Justin has one. Apart from that, they're all clean as a whistle. They don't know Lexi was using an alias. Or if they do, they've said nothing. According to them, she was estranged from her family and didn't like talking about her past. They don't even know where she was from. Abby thinks maybe Galway. Justin thinks Dublin. Daniel gave me a snotty look and told me that wasn't really of interest to him. They're the same about her family. Justin thinks her parents were dead. Rafe says divorced. Abby says she was illegitimate.
Or maybe none of the above, Frank said. We already know our girl wasn't above telling a few little white ones.
Sam nodded.
In September, Daniel inherited Whitethorn House near Glenskeighy from his great uncle, Simon March, and they all moved in. Last Wednesday night, the five of them were home, playing poker. Lexi got knocked out first and went for a walk around 11:30. Late-night walks were a regular part of her routine. The area's safe, the rain hadn't started in yet. The others didn't think twice. They finished up a little after midnight and went to bed. They all described the card game the same way. Who won how much on what hand? Little differences here and there, but that's only natural. We've interviewed all of them several times and they haven't budged an inch. Either they're innocent or they're dead organized.
And the next morning, Frank said, finishing off the timeline with a flourish, she shows up dead.
Sam pulled a handful of papers out of the pile on his desk, went to the whiteboard and stuck something in one corner. A surveyor's map of a patch of countryside, detailed down to the last house and boundary fence, marked with neat X's and squiggles and coloured highlighter.
Here's Glenskeighy Village. Whitethorn House is just under a mile to the south. Here, about halfway in between and a little to the east, that's the derelict cottage where we found our girl. I've marked all the obvious routes she might have taken to get there. The bureau and the uniforms are still searching them. Nothing yet. According to her mates, she always went out the back gate for her walk, wandered around the little lanes for an hour or so. It's a maze of them, all around there. And came home either by the front or by the back, depending on what route took her fancy.
In the middle of the night?
O'Kelly wanted to know.
Was she mental or what?
She always took the torch we found on her, Sam said, unless the night was bright enough to see without. She was mad for the old walks, went out almost every night, even if it was lashing rain. She mostly just bundled up warm and went anyway. I wouldn't say it's exercise she was after, more privacy. Living that close with the other four, it's the only time she got to herself. They don't know whether she ever went to the cottage.
but they did say she liked it. Just after they first moved in, the five of them spent a day wandering all round Glenskeehy, getting the lie of the land. When they spotted the cottage, Lexi wouldn't move on till she'd gone in and had a look around, even though the others told her the farmer would probably be out with a shotgun any minute. She liked that it had been left there, even though no one was using it. Daniel says she likes inefficiency, whatever that means. So we can't rule out the possibility that it was a regular stop on her walks. Definitely not Irish then, or at least not brought up here. Famine cottages are all over the countryside. We barely even see them anymore. It's only tourists, and mostly tourists from newer countries, America, Australia, who look at them long enough to feel their weight. Sam found another piece of paper to add to the whiteboard, a floor plan of the cottage, with a neat, tiny scale at the bottom. However, she ended up there, he said, pressing the last corner into place. That's where she died, against this wall, in what we're calling the outer room. Sometime after death and before rigor set in, she was moved to the inner room. That's where she was found early Thursday morning. He gestured to Cooper. Cooper had been gazing into space in a lofty trance. He took his time, cleared his throat primly, glanced around to make sure he had everyone's full attention. The victim, he said, was a healthy white female, 5 feet 5 inches in height, 120 pounds. No scars, tattoos, or other identifying marks. She had a blood alcohol content of 0.03, consistent with drinking 2 to 3 glasses of wine a few hours previously. The toxicology screen was otherwise clear. At the time of death, she had consumed no drugs, toxins, or medications. All organs were within normal limits. I found no defects or signs of disease. The epiphyses of the long bones are completely fused, and the inner sutures of the skull bones show early signs of fusion, placing her age around the late 20s. It is clear from the pelvis that she has never delivered a child. He reached for his water glass and took a judicious sip, but I knew he wasn't finished. The pause was for effect. Cooper had something up his sleeve. He put down the glass, aligning it neatly in the corner of the desk. She was, however, he said, in the early stages of pregnancy. He sat back and watched the impact. Ah, Jesus, Sam said softly. Frank leaned back against the wall and whistled one long, low note. O'Kelly rolled his eyes. That was all this case needed. I wished I had had the sense to sit down. Any of her mates mention this? I asked. Not a one, Frank said, and Sam shook his head. Our girl kept her friends close and her secrets closer. She might not even have known, I said, if her cycle wasn't regular. Ah, Jesus, Maddox, said O'Kelly, horrified. We don't want to hear about that carry-on. Put it in a report or something. Any chance of IDing the father through DNA? Sam asked. I see no reason why not, Cooper said. Given a sample from the putative father, the embryo was approximately 4 weeks old and just under half a centimetre long and was... Christ, said O'Kelly. Cooper smirked. Skip the bloody details and get on with it. How'd she die? Cooper left a loud pause to show everyone that he wasn't taking orders from O'Kelly. At some point on Wednesday night, he said, when he figured his point was made, she suffered a single stab wound to the right chest. The probability is that the attack came from the front. The angle and point of entry would be difficult to achieve from behind the victim. I found slight abrasions to both palms and one knee, consistent with a fall on hard ground, but no defensive wounds. The weapon was a blade at least 3 inches long,